I guess I'll self-introduce. I'm Sean. I was here for the first two meetings way back when of this caucus, and I don't think it was called the caucus yet. Then I was on hiatus and getting tenure and such, and Amherst pumped me up, so I'm back again. And for those of you who may have seen my presentation, Amherst, this is much of the same material repackaged, so just look at the silly pictures if the material is old news. All right, before beginning, I want to take a moment to thank the musicologist Wiley Hitchcock, the unknowing inspiration for my current research. When I spoke on this topic a few months ago in Amherst, Wiley was the professor in my anecdote about first noticing the resonance between Charles Ives and the Grateful Dead in graduate school. I'm sad to report that Wiley passed away in December, just a few weeks after the conference. He was a scholar equally interested in the cultivated and vernacular traditions, and while we never discussed rock music, after his passing, I wasn't entirely surprised to learn that he brought his family to see several concerts at the Fillmore East, including at least one Dead show. So, thank you, Wiley. In his recent book, Searching for the Sound, Phil Lesh identifies two musicians who specifically exerted a tremendous influence on the embryonic aesthetic of the Grateful Dead. One is John Coltrane, and the other is the early 20th century American composer Charles Ives. This paper explores some of the ways the Dead's music recalls the spirit of Ives, particularly emphasizing their incorporation of his signature techniques of stylistic borrowing and juxtaposition. And let me provide some context for my discussion with a brief recap of the Dead's early discovery of Ives. These events are documented in the standard Dead sources, but I'll interject additional commentary on Ives as I move through the timeline. The story begins with an 18-year-old Phil encountering the book Charles Ives and His Music by Henry and Sidney Cowell. The Cowells were among the early Ives heads, presenting him as, quote, one of the four great creative figures in music of the first half of the 20th century. And some of you may know Cowell as the dedicatee of Space for Henry Cowell, an improvisation performed with the San Francisco Symphony conductor Michael Tilson Thomas in 1996. Phil describes his encounter with the book, writing that, quote, the examples introduced me to truly original compositions, the song The Majority, with its notated tone clusters and unmetered barring, and the Concord Sonata with its free polyphony for two hands written on three staves. It almost didn't matter what the music sounded like. It looked so cool on the page, end quote. Phil is seemingly conflating later experiences because the examples in the Cowell book don't precisely match this description, but let's take a look at them. Example 1A shows the tone clusters for Majority that intrigued Phil, and a pianist would perform these either with a forearm or a block of wood. And 1B is a copy of the most polyphonic example from the Concord Sonata that's in the Cowell's text. While Ives' information and recordings were relatively scarce in the late 50s, that's certainly not the case today. So let's listen to the opening few seconds of these two works to get some Ivesian sounds in your ears. And while we listen, I'll show you the more complete notation that likely further informed Phil's description of the music. Okay, and first we'll hear the opening system of Majority with its tone clusters, and you also want to note the free meter and lack of bar lines that Phil mentions. And in that first system, there's things that look kind of like bars, but they're rolls. So no bars in that first system. So let's take a listen. And next, we'll hear the first two systems of Emerson, the first movement of the Concord Sonata. And as you listen, note the familiar Beethoven quotation at the end of the example. And this is probably my own problem, but somehow I hear a twisted morning dew in the opening. you don't have to go there if you don't want. Thank you. Phil's description implies that he gravitated as much to Ives' ideas as to his sounding music. He continues, quote, "The power and freshness of his music, together with the story of his life, neglect, misunderstanding, unwillingness to compromise in order to earn a living as a musician, going into insurance and making a fortune, composing at night, using his wealth to promote new music other than his own, made him, in my eyes, an artistic hero. All this before I ever heard a note of the music, as there were no recordings available to me until years later." End quote. It seems that the initial influence on Phil was Ives, the legendary American musical hero, and only later it was the sounding music. This separation of idealized abstraction and literal sounding music parallels the conceptual duality of substance versus matter that Ives explains in his essays before Sonata. Ives writes, "The higher and more important value of this dualism is composed of what may be called reality, quality, spirit, or substance, against the lower value of form, quantity, or manner." He continues, suggesting that substance has its birth in the spiritual consciousness and is appreciated by the intuition and somehow translated into expression by manner, a process always less important than it seems. Of course, we must keep in mind that manner, being the external reality of a work, that is, the sounds we actually hear, is necessary to communicate substance. This duality is particularly important for my research because the half century that separates the music of Ives and the Dead generates substantial differences in manner. Symphony orchestra versus rock band, classically trained versus vernacular singers, notated versus oral traditions, etc. In other words, the musical examples I'm playing for you this afternoon sound rather different on the musical surface. The relations I'm suggesting are deeper than these superficial parameters. Instead, they're at the level of substance. Still, as I just pointed out, we can only examine this deeper similarity through the surface manner of the sounding music. Okay, back to my narrative. By 1967, Phil and the Dead had heard, rather than just viewed, Ives' music, as illustrated by a live radio broadcast from April of that year in which Jerry and Phil were guest DJs playing 20 recordings that were major influences on them. Nestled among less surprising recordings by artists such as Charles Mingus and Bob Dylan, there was just one classical track, the second movement of Charles Ives' Fourth Symphony. So let's listen to their introduction and the first minute of the track they played, and this is DJ Tom Donahue with Phil and Jerry. Also note the Stones track that they did play, which was early, as an influence.
Composition of Charles Ives, Symphony Number 4, and we're going to play the second movement from it. If you expect it to sound like a symphony, forget it, it'd be disappointing.
Phil also comments on the Fourth Symphony in his book, stating, quote, "This particular piece of music was welded into my DNA, ever since I'd heard the record mysteriously appear as background music for one of my finest trips." And he continues, describing it as simultaneously sounding layers of different musics, hymn tunes, marches, popular songs of Ives' day, all woven together within a fantastical flux of sound, end quote. We didn't hear this aspect of the symphony in that previous excerpt, so let's listen to a later passage from the same movement so you get the full impact. The song titles scrolling across the screen are all the tunes borrowed by Ives in just this single movement. They're not aligned with them.
Thank you.
Given the extreme complexity of the music, it may seem like this is primarily an interest of Phil's, but the whole band, including Pigpen, attended a performance of the symphony in December 1967, conducted by Leopold Stokowski in Carnegie Hall, and they were all, quote, blown completely away, end quote. Mickey even decided that it was life-transforming and that they needed to do something similar with their music. Along with the fantastical flux of sound, what seems to have captured the band's imagination was how the sense of space, height, width, depth was palpable, as well as its transcendental qualities. I might similarly point out that these same three characteristics, I might use them to describe my interest in the music of the Grateful Dead, although I'm only focusing on the first component in today's pick. One of Ives' core compositional techniques is musical borrowing, ranging from quotation through paraphrase to more general stylistic imitation. Musicologist Peter Burkholder identifies 14 different methods of borrowing in Ives' music, as shown in this slide. Number 11 would be what Jake was discussing yesterday about cumulative setting, where you get a fragment at the beginning of a work and eventually it coalesces into a complete statement, or more complete statement. As you may intuit, there's a great deal of overlap among these categories, and only a few are pertinent to my talk today. The first two items in my reduced list, quotation and medley, need less explanation than the others, but I'll touch upon them briefly. Literal quotation plays a substantial role in Ives' music, and in addition to the mayhem heard in that last excerpt, you may recall the motive from Beethoven's Fifth Symphony at the end of the earlier Concord Sonata example. Such literal borrowing plays a lesser role in the Dead's music, but it does exist, from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in Born Cross-Eyed through Ring Around the Rosie and Throwing Stones. I'll play just one very obvious example to make my point, the instrumental We Bid You Goodnight at the end of Going Down the Road. As my caption suggests, this example also illustrates the overlap among Burkholder's categories. This is an instance of transcription from vocal melody to guitar line. It's part of a medley, not fade away into going down the road into the instrumental, all of which are borrowed. And finally, Jerry's improvisatory quotation strays enough from the original to be understood as paraphrase. One might also consider the manner in which cover songs emerge and recede during the primordial flow of the second set the quintessential Dead enactment of both medley and quotation. As hinted at in the previous example, paraphrase plays a significant role in the Dead's music, and the technique is particularly noticeable in Jerry's solos. While this may stem from the jazz practice of keeping the head melody in mind while improvising, there's something simultaneously more literal and more stream of consciousness in Jerry's approach. Throughout his solos, we hear an impression of the song's vocal line, a stitching together of melodic fragments rather than totally free improvisation or a literal statement of the head. And here's an example. Many solos articulate the melodic fragments less directly than that example, and the rhythmic and pitch transformations frequently remind me of Ives' use of paraphrase, specifically as illustrated by Burkholder in his research. A similar study could be made of the relation between Jerry's solos and his sung melodies. More pervasive than any of those techniques is general stylistic illusion. Within the Dead's complete repertoire, the broad range of style is self-evident and hardly needs explanation, but I'm referring to closer stylistic juxtapositions that resonate with Ives. For example, in these solo passages from Sugar Ree, you hear first blues, then banjo, and finally mandolin techniques, all representing individual American folk idioms, yet coalescing in Jerry's unique electric style. So here's first blues-influenced bending. Thank you. banjo-style arpeggiations. Mandolin-style tremolos. More interesting is the direct superimposition of independent musical styles. For example, take the jug band tune Viola Lee Blues by Gus Cannon and his Jug Stompers.
He judged, he pleaded, like he wrote it, like he wrote it, down in the head. He judged, he pleaded, think like he wrote it down. If you miss deal, sinner,
plus the R&B groove of Lee Dorsey's Get Out My Life Woman.
Get out my life, woman. You don't love me no more. Get out my life, woman. You don't love me no more.
And the juxtaposition results in the Dead's Viola Lee Blues. Phil describes this juxtaposition in his book, writing, quote, "A good example of this technique is our version of the old Noah Lewis jug band tune, Viola Lee Blues, a traditional prison song. We electrified the song with a boogaloo beat and an intro lick borrowed from R&B artist Lee Dorsey's Get Out My Life Woman," end quote. As before, there's a little memory slippage here. Alligator actually borrows the intro of Get Out My Life Woman, while Viola Lee Blues borrows the groove, particularly the backbeat guitar punches. Still, the carving up of source material for different songs, as well as the direct juxtaposition of different sources, gives this derivation additional meaning in the context of the Ives influence. Bard music is not only incorporated sonically in Ives' compositions, many of his over 100 songs also include textual references to music or music making. This is perhaps my favorite resonance with the Dead, as they similarly spend much of their time making music about music, from the Golden Road to Black Muddy River. And this brings me to a subtle example, the end of the song Stagger Lee. In this excerpt, Delia walks past a three-piece band on the corner playing Near My God to Thee. This is a beautiful example of diegetic music in the Dead repertoire. This song plays a similar role in Charles Ives' song, Down East, in which the singer is reminiscing about tunes his mother used to play on her melodeon. Let's listen to the end of this song.
Every Sunday morning, when
This direct correspondence is interesting, but the technique is not unique, even if it may be decidedly American. Similar references along with melodic quotations are also common to Tin Pan Alley composers such as George M. Cohan and Irving Berlin. However, the hymn tune Bethany, the one most commonly used for the text Nearer My God to Thee, is one of Ives' most frequently quoted tunes. It makes instrumental cameos in dozens of works, including a couple of the movements of his Fourth Symphony, embedded in the kind of cacophony we heard earlier. What gives the Dead's usage a truly Ivesian twist is that Delia is whistling and singing another tune against the band on the corner, creating a diegetic Ivesian juxtaposition. In fact, for us outsiders listening to Jerry's non-diegetic narration of the story, that is, hearing the song Stagger Lee itself, we have a collage of three musical streams. I can't help but think of Ives in this context. I'd like to conclude by identifying a few additional correspondences for future consideration in no particular order of significance. First, they share a total immersion in literature with Emerson and the Transcendentalists for Ives and Kerouac and the Beats for the Dead. One might compare Ives' obsession with sports, particularly baseball, to Bob, most notably his long forthcoming Satchel Paige musical. They both share an environmentalist attitude. Ives' song, The New River, suggests the river gods were already dead from noise and pollution almost 100 years ago. Ives and the Dead both demonstrate radical socioeconomic moderation. At the recent Amherst conference, publicist Dennis McNally described Jerry's aversion to stockpiling money. Ives similarly proposed a maximum property limit for all people in his essay, The Majority, and when he finally won the Pulitzer Prize in 1947, he gave away the prize money to a more needy composer. The final bullet point is borrowed from a chapter titled in Larry Starr's book on Charles Ives, A Union of Diversities. In the music of both Ives and the Dead, there's simultaneously a nostalgic sense of the past, some works could almost be characterized as historical fiction, and a visionary sense of the future, nearly science fiction. The lyric, Moses came riding up on a quasar, his spurs were a-jingling, the door was ajar, comes to mind as a random example. The result of this delicate balancing of nostalgia and modernism is an emphasis on the present, the now. Starr describes this best, and I'll finish with a relatively long quotation from his chapter on the topic. Ives is interested in the present. This is not the present of a particular time, place, person, or culture. Rather, it is an always extant and ever-changing artistic present, the current intellectual, emotional, and spiritual condition of creator, performer, and listener. In short, humanity. Ives' music seeks to engage the present as it is being lived and experienced, and to move with and through that present meaningfully into a new present enriched by the experience of the music. Aspects of the past and potential for the future are an inescapable part of the present, of course, and Ives' music directly acknowledges this. Yet the goal of his art almost always seems to be that of immersing us more deeply in the experience of the present rather than in some past experience, real or imagined, or in some imagined future experience. I would be completely comfortable placing the name Ives with the Dead throughout that description. Mm.